Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you very much for being here on this Thursday morning. We have a number of public hearings, and we also have possible work sessions. So first, I want to make an announcement. At this point, if you're here on Senate Bill 487, which is scheduled for a work session, we will not do that today. The chair's looking at setting that for next Wednesday. I've got some other work I need to do. So at this point, if you're here on 487, it will not be heard today. So for those who want to go have coffee or whatever else and clear the room, feel free to do so. All right, what we're going to go ahead and do is, because of timing for members, I'm going to go ahead and open up our first public hearing. This will be in Senate Bill 571. Josh, if you can give us the overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 571 prohibits a public body from using cell site simulators to obtain personal electronic data or metadata unless the public body obtains that data pursuant to a warrant, a recognized exception to the warrant requirement, or with the consent of the person who owns or uses the electronic communication device. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, so we have Senator Knope here. Tim, if you'll come up, do you want the other individuals that are in support is Kimberly McCullough and Gail Meyer. Would you like them with you, or do you? I know you have a timing.
They can come up separately.
Okay.
Yeah.
All righty.
Thank you, Chair Frozonski and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Tim Knope from Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. And I am with you this morning to advocate for Senate Bill 751. Which would prohibit public entities from using cell phone simulator devices, say that three times fast, cell phone simulator devices to obtain use for personal or electronic data, as your counsel said. I am asking you to do what 10 states have done, including California, Washington, and others, and that's to limit the use of what's called stingrays. So kingfish, amberjack, Hailstorm, those are not Hollywood movies. They're not video games. They're actually devices that are called stingrays. And essentially, and I know, I think you guys, I don't know how many of you were able to attend, but I understand that a demonstration was made possible for you on this. I didn't get a chance to do that. But cell site simulators, also commonly known as IMSI catchers, or stingrays, are devices that masquerade as a legitimate cell phone tower, tricking phones nearby into connecting to a device in order to log the IMSI information of mobile phones in the area and to capture content, communications, and source. And if you're looking for more information on this, you can go to EFF.org. It's a good site that lists lots of questions and answers and information about the topic that we are discussing. Essentially, colleagues, I believe the current use of cell site simulators violates the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution and Article 1, Section 9 of the Oregon Constitution, both of which guarantee citizens' rights to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. Let me just say that I admire and support law enforcement, and this bill should not be seen in any way as anti-law enforcement, but pro-freedom and pro-constitution. And I can't imagine anyone actually opposing the bill. So the Fourth Amendment and subsequent state constitutional protections against unreasonable search and seizure originated from opposition to the use of general search warrants used by British colonial governments. These warrants granted police the power to search any home at any time for any reason. The current unrestricted employment of cell site simulators is frighteningly similar to the abusive British warrants in that there are no specificity to these searches and no specific rationale given to gather the data of individuals or whole communities. So, colleagues, I am not anti-cell site simulator, but I do believe that they need to be used, and there needs to be a bright line created for law enforcement. And so I don't believe that you should have to seek court redress to ratify your Fourth Amendment rights or your Article 1, Section 9 rights in the Constitution. And so if these are being used, I just believe that there needs to be a warrant there. And so the burning question I know that is on all of your minds, how soon can we notice this bill for work session? I would say hopefully as soon as possible, because I believe this is a standalone. I think it's a very simple bill. And I think the arguments really at the end of the day are quite simple. And as I said, California and Washington have already acted on this, California in a more comprehensive way than Washington. But I would encourage your support of Senate Bill 751 so we can let Oregon citizens know that they can have those constitutional protections and that these won't be used unless, of course, there is a probable cause warrant. And with that, committee, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Questions for Senator Knope? Tim, thank you.
Chair, I don't have a question. I'm just a comment. I'm just really impressed with your use of sibilance, Senator. And I'm wondering how many of them you're going to get into your floor speech when you present this bill.
Yes, we'll do our best.
All right. Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. So we're going to go ahead and call up the other individuals that are here to testify, at least the ones that are listed. Kimberly and Gail, want you to come on up, and I'm going to ask Kevin Campbell to go ahead and come on up so we can just fill the table. Is there anyone else besides these three who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 571? All right. So, ladies, I'll let you start off since you're on the proponent side.
Okay. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I want to start just because this is the first time this session that we've been talking about digital privacy, or that I've been talking about digital privacy with you all, to just sort of frame the issue about why privacy is so important. I think we often think about privacy as far as like the feeling of personal violation that we have, which is certainly very important. That's a very important aspect of privacy and why we should be concerned about surveillance. But I would also argue that our privacy rights are intertwined with other rights that we have and with other concerns that this legislature pays attention to. I've given you guys a handout, and I will post that online as well, but just in case you want to follow along. But essentially, one of the most important things that privacy intertwines with is our rights to free speech. So people who know that they're being watched, in particular when they have unpopular opinions, are much less likely to actually express those opinions. And there's been some recent research that's actually quite interesting on this point, which is that there's people who often will say, oh, I don't have anything to hide, and so I'm not really worried. I would argue that we actually all do have things that we hide, and they're not necessarily bad things. They're just things that we don't want to share. But that the people who say, I have nothing to hide, I'm not worried about being watched by government, are actually the people who are most likely to alter their behavior when they know that they're being watched. So the psychological studies that they've done have actually shown that. So free speech, I think, is a super important aspect of this. Also, our free association rights. If people feel like their location, in particular with their location, if their location is being tracked, where they go to church, where they go to the doctor, what kinds of protests they go to, and so on. So our privacy rights are also intertwined with our free association. We also know that surveillance historically in the United States has been used disproportionately against communities of color and low-income communities, so we have concerns about how it interacts with profiling. And then when data is collected, just generally, it can be misused. There are unfortunately examples of different types of surveillance being used to surveil ex-partners or people that folks don't like, and so on. And then also anytime that there's data collected, there is risk of that information being shared. So I just wanted to share those kind of just general frames about privacy and digital privacy and why it's so important. I also, on this handout that I gave you, there is a website. It's called theyarewatching.org. That's actually an ACLU website. It has a whole bunch of really great information about all the different reasons that privacy is so important, and it has also a bunch of information about different types of surveillance technology, because stingrays are just one example of many, many different types of technology. And our general feeling about it is that the most, it's not that we don't want surveillance technology to be used, but that we want it to be disclosed. We want people to know about it. We want the public to have an engaged conversation about how it is used and how our privacy rights are being protected. So I also have some information about stingrays here. I understand that you have had an opportunity to see them. I know that there are some stingrays that are not very sophisticated. There are also stingrays that have been developed that are more sophisticated. And I think when we're thinking about legislation on issues like this, we need to be thinking about where technology is going. Part of the problem is that the courts have a really hard time keeping up. And so I think we really need to be forward thinking about where is this going, and can we curb its use before it actually gets there. So there's some nice little charts here that show you how they work. I won't go through all of the details, but just wanted to use this opportunity to educate the committee a bit about the issue and why we think it's so important. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Przonski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I'd just like to make a few comments as to why we think it's important for this legislative body to step up and address this very important issue. And that's because the courts really have been fairly crippled in addressing this issue in a comprehensive way for two reasons. Often the use of an electronic surveillance tool is not disclosed in the course of a criminal case, even though it has been used. And secondly, to get a definitive answer out of the courts addressing these issues sometimes can take many, many, many years, and then you have its use being used throughout the nation without really a definitive answer. So there clearly is a search component here to the capturing of this data with a cell site simulator. Again, as Kimberly pointed out, some of them are sophisticated enough to actually record conversations on phones and to retrieve and secure incoming and outgoing text messages. It definitely can show private details behind the walls of a home. Is that cell phone in that home, or is that cell phone someplace else? It can also capture data that's been stored on a person's phone, and it can also do real-time, present-moment cell phone location, so it can actually help people figure out where you've been and where you're going. This can evade judicial review for a few reasons. Number one, it's not often disclosed in a search warrant application itself that a cell site simulator has been employed that lead to the understanding of following evidence that follows. So in occasions that there's been a search warrant affidavit, sometimes it can say in the affidavit, we observed the defendant leave the home located at X and then drive away. It doesn't reveal how they knew that the defendant was even in that home. And it's been shown in some other cases that they knew the defendant was in that home because they'd used the cell site simulator to locate the phone inside that home. And then they knew to surveil the home, and then they saw the defendant leave it. So the point of it is that sometimes the search warrant applications pick up where the cell site simulator stops off. There have been, and again, there's not a lot of public disclosure of this stuff, so we can only base it on what we've read in the media or what we know from other cases. But what we are told is that the manufacturers of these simulators insist upon non-disclosure agreements with law enforcement that they don't disclose in open court, in search warrant applications, that these devices have been employed. And so often then, the defense lawyer is clueless to know, and the courts are clueless to know that there's been the deployment of a simulator in the initial throes of an investigation. Secondly, it takes a long time to get definitive answers on this out of the court system. You can have some split in the circuits until it gets up to the U.S. Supreme Court. We think that things are settling down. The courts are pretty much coming down to the fact of this is a search, and you need a search warrant application. But again, there's a lot of resistance sometimes to full disclosure of what's being used and how it's being used. So we think it's important for this legislative body to step up. I think it's a very important conversation to have, and we're looking forward to contributing to it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Kevin?
Chair Przonski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. So I won't say that I'm opposed to the bill in light of Senator Knope's encouragement. I'll just express very strong concern with the bill, and not actually because of what it's asking for, but because we believe that, as we've mentioned recently during our trip out to the Academy that I think Senator Dimbro was unable to be at, that our statutes are in desperate need of modernization across the board. But because they're antiquated doesn't mean that law enforcement is not seeking warrants for use of these kind of devices. The reason for that is it's extremely important to law enforcement to do everything they can to ensure that a case moving forward, we've dotted the I's and crossed the T's. Law enforcement is in a unique position here at the table because we have constitutional and mission requirements to care both about public safety and privacy rights. It's not an either or. In this case, the bill takes a technology and applies a standard to it. So if passed, the legislature may come back every time a new technology is introduced to set a standard regarding how law enforcement might proceed to utilize a technology in an investigation. In this case, I can tell you that, as you know, with the Stingray now, we seek a warrant. So the requirements of the bill are being fulfilled, but again, we support a more comprehensive conversation so that the determination about what law enforcement does in use of any technology now or in the future would be judged based on what kind of information you're actually seeking and obtaining, so that we would have a progressive court oversight as the information that we're seeking is more private. And we think that's a better standard, a more comprehensive approach. So for that reason, we can't support this bill. Another bill we'll hear this morning was an attempt to try to create a structure. We realize that that's going to require more conversation that we're committed to having. But that one, if passed, would require the warrant for this type of technology. So it's not that we're not interested in making sure that we're doing everything we can to get the kind of court oversight that provides confidence to the public. But again, a technology-by-technology approach is not our preference. We think there's a better, more comprehensive way of modernizing our statutes and giving clear guidance that I think will give the public confidence and give law enforcement and the courts a brighter line on these kind of technologies. So with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I did want to mention that there are many things the Stingray has been accused of being able to do. And I'm sure there are various types of stingrays. I've went back to our folks that actually deal with these technologies after characterizations are made about how much they can do. And I'm often told, and you saw the one that was that's in use here, it's a little bit underwhelming actually as a technology. And some of the it's easy to say, you know, we can listen to phone calls and read text messages. You know, sometimes we conflate what federal government agencies do with what state police or local police are able to do. It's a different world. We don't have access to that technology. But I can tell you with confidence that the stingrays that are in use here are pretty underwhelming. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Senator Manning first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I am concerned about is how the private entity is connected with the use of these devices. There is no contractual agreement, as I understand, that would prohibit them from using that data for their own use. I think that there are some concerns as well about the privacy of individual rights. My question to you is whether or not you are willing to engage with the proponents of this bill to kind of come with something, some kind of terms that you both can agree upon. My main concern, again, is private entity having, because you're using that technology and they have access to that, how much of that would they have, and then how would they disseminate that? I think that is the main question that I have.
Chair Przanski and Senator Manning, I think that when we have the testimony on the next bill, you'll hear both of us committing to that very process. It is an important process to navigate. It has to be done well, and all parties need to get to the table. It is a changing world, so there is increased complexity around everything from criminal enterprises and how criminal enterprises utilize technology. And yet we need to continue on the law enforcement side, in essence, to tie one arm behind our backs in order to make sure that we are protecting the privacy rights of citizens and not being a part of access to information that's not appropriate based on investigation. So we're committed to that.
Okay, just one quick follow-up. I'm a former police officer, and I know we got a lot of great officers out there. So I would disagree that tying their arm, one arm behind their back, is not like that. These are great investigators. So, come straight.
Yeah, so Chair Przanski and Senator Manning, my point is that we restrict ourselves in order to ensure that privacy rights are protected. So the one arm behind our back is not it's what the public demands. So that but I think we could all safely assume that a criminal enterprise has really no care for the rights of people, privacy rights, care for their lives. We just so the picture is not designed to cast a dispersion on any policing. It's actually to say we really care about making sure we do it right. And so, thank you.
Any other questions, Senator?
No.
Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. It was mentioned, I think Senator Knope brought it up, that Washington and California have enacted similar legislation. And I'm wondering if you have heard that it has negatively impacted their abilities to, any of you, if you've heard whether this has changed their abilities in investigating criminal activity, and if so, how has it been? I don't know. I'm just wondering if you've heard anything as a result.
So Chair Przanski and Senator Thatcher, no, but every state has their own battle to set policy regarding how information is accessed by law enforcement. And so my point in terms of this bill is that we are seeking warrants now. We're doing exactly what the bill asks us to do. But again, our preference, instead of passing a bill every time a new technology comes out, is to create a framework that addresses technologies across the board so we're not having to revisit it. That's the main issue. So thank you.
Any other questions? All right, proponents, any cases, as you know, here in the state of Oregon where there's not been a warrant?
Chair Przanski, we don't know what we don't know.
So, and under your example, Gil, if you had a officer who's on the beat, they've got a license plate on a vehicle, they drive by a house, they see a car parked there, has the same license plate, they have to seek a warrant, or they're wanting to seek a warrant, because, and they are able to establish that the person was at that residence. So the difference there versus them coming in contact with some other information that someone may be there through electronic means, I'm not sure if I'm tracking why that would should be prohibited in one way, but in another way it shouldn't.
Chair Przanski, I'm not clear that I completely understand your question, but I'm just simply saying what has been gleaned from affidavits. The defense bar has become aware, and this is more a national perspective than one that I can tether specifically to Oregon, but on the national perspective, is that what's been disclosed, uncovered ultimately, is that there has been use of cell site simulator information that has led law enforcement to understand certain facts. Those certain facts are repeated in the search warrant affidavit. The use and deployment of a device has not been disclosed in the search warrant affidavit.
All right.
Or they might say they know of a fact and they simply say it came from a confidential, reliable source. And so then these are just simply not gleaned out. And it takes a long time for a court to get to a place where they're actually like, I want to know more about that device. That's the rare motion to suppress that actually results in that kind of a hearing.
Chair Przanski, if you wouldn't mind if I just jump in, and I'd just like to repeat what Kevin said as well, is that, you know, we're committed to working together to try to find a path forward on you know, comprehensive reform of our electronic privacy laws just generally. But I think the question you were asking, because I've heard this question before, and correct me if I'm wrong, is, you know, that like, say, for example, a car is driving around or something like that, that you can observe someone's location sort of what's the difference between being able to just an officer observe someone location and the use of something like a cell site simulator. And I think that the Oregon Supreme Court has actually drawn a line analyzing our own search and seizure laws or Article 1, Section 9 related to GPS in a way that I think is helpful, which is that certainly law enforcement can observe somebody walking down the street or you know, doing various things, and that they certainly don't need a warrant to do that. But it's when that information becomes very, very comprehensive that the privacy invasion becomes more severe. So when you can actually track where someone has gone over a course of many, many days, then that is a more severe privacy violation than just seeing somebody walking down the street once or twice. It sort of the analogy would sort of be as if, you know, there was like an officer that was assigned to every person to walk with them everywhere that they went. I think we would all kind of think like, oh gosh, that's too much of a privacy violation. It's a lot different than just having an officer on the corner that happens to see folks. Or even is investigating a person and is limited somewhat by the physical act and what is required. So there is a GPS case in Oregon where there was a GPS monitor that was placed on a vehicle, and the Oregon Supreme Court reached its decision in that case differently than the Supreme Court did. The federal Supreme Court said placing a GPS monitor was a violation of your property rights, whereas the Oregon Supreme Court said, well, no, they put the GPS on there and it was on there for 30 days. That 30 days of collecting information about your location is more of a privacy intrusion. So hopefully that helps just clarify our thoughts on that.
Okay, so I want to follow up with Kevin a couple of questions for you on the corporate information. We heard Senator Manning's concern as to how it could be used privacy. Can you tell us what type of arrangements, and in the sense of this equipment, first of all, is it owned by the company and it's somehow leased to us? The one, you know, I'm going to use the example that we saw, which I assume was the state police, within the possession of the state police. I'll just say it that way.
Yeah, Chair Przanski and members of the committee, my understanding of the technology and its capabilities, it cannot retain data. So it's that particular device does not retain it. And it doesn't have cell phone numbers or personal identification information attached to it. So it really has kind of a dual, as you know from the demonstration, it has a dual piece. It can measure signal strength, and it can, once it identifies a device, and it can measure direction. So it's kind of like, you know, the game of, you know, hotter, no, cooler. It is it is an underwhelming technology. I will need to check to see what the ownership is of that. I assume it is actually owned by the agency. I have to check with them regarding disclosure policy, but they obviously were willing to give you a look. So,
right. I mean, we actually, as you said, got to have an opportunity to see it in action as it worked, and the way you've described it is what I took away. So I don't see where there's any data that's being collected and somehow received. Do you know as when the I'm going to just call it Stingray is in operation, if any third parties have access to what's currently occurring with the operation of that equipment?
So, Chair Przanski, I don't want to get over my skis. I need to check, but I don't believe so. So yeah. I can check and get back to you on that.
Do you know how many Stingrays or similar type of devices are retained here in the state?
Chair Przanski, I believe there is one.
In other words, there's, as far as you know, there's no city police agencies that have a independently owned or leased or whatever type of.
So I need to check who owns that one particular Stingray, but yes.
City, because my understanding, this is in the state possession, and it's either through DOJ or it's with the state police or a combination.
Yeah, Chair Przanski, I need to check on that because it could be a city. But I believe there's just one device in the state.
All right. And it's your testimony that whenever one of these apparatuses are going to be used in the state of Oregon, that it's current practice that a warrant is, in fact, sought and received before it's used?
Chair Prezanski and members of the committee, yes, that is true.
Right. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. Great. Is there anyone else, again, who wants to give testimony on 571? Not seeing one running up here. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing of Senate Bill 571, and we'll go ahead and go back to the top of our agenda, and we'll take a public hearing on Senate Bill 515. Josh?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 515 modernizes the definitions of pen register and trap and trace device, describes the circumstances when law enforcement may use a pen register or trap and trace device without a warrant or court order. The bill describes the circumstances under which personal electronic data, location data, or subscriber information may be obtained by law enforcement with and without a warrant, court order, or subpoena. Finally, the bill modifies the circumstances under which law enforcement may utilize a mobile tracking device. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. So at this point, I probably should have just had virtually half the people or two-thirds of the people stay up there. So Kevin, Kimberly, and Aaron, if y'all will come up. While they're getting situated, is there any other people, individuals who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 515? All right. Who's going to lead off the show? Everyone's neutral on this, so that's a great starting place.
Chair Prezanski and members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Campbell again on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I've indicated neutral simply because what we're prepared to say again to the committee is that we're committed to work together to bring this committee and the legislature a proposal based on a conversation to figure out how to address these privacy protections and that progressive access to information that requires increasing scrutiny by the courts. It's a big project. The bill that you see before you is the product of a group called the Law Enforcement Responsible Technology Work Group. It's just a starting point. I know that the ACLU has products as well and approaches to this. It's a matter of sitting down and trying to figure out what's best for the state of Oregon. So I just am here to commit to that conversation and to work with Kimberly and Aaron to sit down and work through that.
Chair Prezanski, members of the committee, Kimberly McCullough, ACLU of Oregon. I just want to echo everything that Kevin said. As he mentioned, we do have, ACLU does also have sort of model privacy legislation on this issue based on some legislation that was passed in California. But as you'll see when you read this bill, and as you would see if you looked at the California Electronic Communication Privacy Act, they are long, dense, complicated bills with a lot of nuance and a lot of downstream consequences that aren't necessarily always obvious from looking at all of the various provisions. We have engaged in conversations about these issues for quite some time now, but again, they're very, very complicated issues. So we're committed to trying to find a way to merge our ideas and law enforcement's ideas and DOJ's ideas into something that we can all stand behind and feel proud of. So just committed to continuing to do this work together.
Chair Prezanski, members of the committee, Aaron Knott here, legislative director for the Attorney General, Oregon Department of Justice. And yeah, it's a good bill, should pass, but in the future. Because of the complexity of this issue, we really do need to have one approach where we sort of figure out how privacy works. We're not playing whack-a-mole issue to issue. And the Department of Justice sees the need for a coherent approach. We will commit whatever resources we need to making it happen. And we look forward to coming back to you at the right time with a fully developed proposal that hopefully we can all support.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 515. And we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which is Senate Bill 483.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 483 creates a crime of unlawful use of a global positioning device, punishes as a Class A misdemeanor, or if the defendant has certain stalking-related previous convictions or is subject to a restraining order, punishes as a Class C felony. Additionally, there is a -1 amendment before you today that expressly protects a law enforcement officer acting pursuant to a court order or warrant. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and call David Lewis up. Dave, I forget, detective, is that correct?
I'm sergeant.
Sergeant, yes, sir. All right. Well, thank you very much for being here, taking the time. Just for committee, this bill that we're going to be hearing came to my attention through actually an article that was in the newspaper, the Register Guard, regarding where you had an individual, and Sergeant Lewis will go over it, that basically placed a GPS on a strange individual that they had been in a relationship. And it was just one of those situations, just kind of like, wait a second, this should be against the law. So,
thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Yes, we have actually two cases in Springfield that have highlighted the need for this bill, and both of them involve potential.
Dave, I need you to put your name on the record.
Oh,
I apologize.
I'm sorry, it's David Lewis. Right. I'm the detective sergeant with the Springfield Police Department. In the first case, which happened in July of 2016, a ER nurse had a flat tire and went down to a local place to get it fixed, and they found this tracking device put on her car and asked her if she knew anything about it. Of course she didn't, but she also had a stalking order against an ex-boyfriend. During that investigation, we were able to take the device, download the information on it, and identify the person through an IP address. And in that case, we were able to charge him with a violation of his stalking order, but not the continuous taking off of and putting back on of the device. It's my understanding that these things take, you have 2-week battery life on some of them or even less. And so this guy had it on for a period of more than 2 months, and he was going every so often and tracking all of her movements. And this obviously, the potential for violence for something like that, for someone who has to get a court order against somebody, following them around and knowing where they're at all times is really the potential is pretty bad right there. In the second case, it was a woman from Beaverton who had moved down here who actually found the device on her car and didn't know what it was and called us. And in our investigation into that, we found that she had had a bad relationship with a person in Beaverton and actually got a restraining order at one point in that situation. And then their attorneys got together and had the restraining order dropped. We did not do any investigation into who owned the device until a private investigator called us because he knew the device was positioned at the Springfield Police Department. And that investigation, we found out that the private investigator was hired, if you will, by her ex-boyfriend who used to have the court order against him to apply this device on her car so he could monitor her movements also. But the interesting thing I found out doing research about that case is this is probably a tip of the iceberg incident to people who are obsessed with a partner or a former spouse, because the private investigator told me that there's basically what he does is rent these devices out to clients. So he removes himself from any liability of what might happen, and actually even inquiring further about whether there's any court orders or anything like that. So he can say, I just rented this device to him, I don't know what he's going to do with it. And something bad could, you know, potentially happen from that. You know, we're in that case, we got it, we identified everybody involved, and you know, obviously, I'm thinking this is obviously against the law. You can't be doing this. The law enforcement is required to have a search warrant to do such a thing, and rightfully so. And in our investigation with the district attorney's office in Lane County, we went through all possible crimes, stalking, criminal mischief, unlawful entry of motor vehicle. None of them seemed to fit. And this bill really actually helps us out quite a lot in being able to remedy that. And I think that, you know, these things aren't easy to see. They're little magnetic things that go up on the frame of a car. So I think that you're going to see a lot more of this in the future.
Thank you. Questions for Detective Sergeant Lewis?
Thank you for your time.
All right, Dave, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming up. And, oh, Dave, one other question, if I could.
Yes.
We did get one other inquiry, and I just want to make sure, put this on the record so it's on the record and just get your input. Apparently, some of the trucking organizations, meaning common carriers, they will lease equipment, let's say from like Penske,
okay,
and then they will actually use it in their motor carrying business, and they will actually, the lessee of the vehicle from Penske, So this would be the motor carrier company. Let's say ABC Freight Company actually will put a GPS on the vehicle while they have it in their possession, so they can track and monitor their employees of where they're going and stuff like that. I've been asked to consider that in our deliberation, and I'm assuming so long as we narrowed out an exception for legitimate business such as transportation carriers, you would not see a problem with that?
No, I wouldn't. In fact, you know, I think that as long as there's language about consent also, because I know that there's a less than reputable car dealership who does it also when they, you know, they sell people with their have little or no credit or bad credit, and they will go find their car when the payments aren't notice. Paid, that kind of thing. I think that as long as it's contractual and consensual, it would be no problem for us.
All right. All right, thank you very much. Any questions by Senator Lithicum?
Your point's a good point, Mr. Chair. The UPS and FedEx use those universally in all of their trucks and tracking, and so carving that section out would certainly be appropriate.
Yeah, I think the bill itself would cover them if they own the vehicle. This is a situation where if the trucking is leasing the vehicle, so now they're not, as the bill says, the owner without the consent of the owner. So, but we'll take care of that. I think that's a good point, and that was raised. And so we do have a dash one that we're going to be bringing forward, and that gives some limitations, if I remember correctly. And so we'll get that together, and then hopefully we'll have it on its way.
Okay.
Thank you very much. All right, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 483? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close that public hearing. And this brings us to Senate Bill, our last public hearing, Senate Bill 508. And Josh, if you can give us the overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 508 conditionally exempts from public disclosure images that are part of a law enforcement investigation and that relate to the death of a person.
All right, I'm going to ask Sergeant Hanlon and as well as Kevin Neely if you two would come forward. While they're coming up, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 508? Well, Sheriff Hamlin, when you're ready, I'm going to go ahead and let you get started, since this was a bill that you brought to our attention this last session.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Hanlon. I am the sheriff of Douglas County and currently serving my third term as sheriff. I want to thank you for allowing me the time to testify today. I am before you in support of Senate Bill 508. I have been the Douglas County Sheriff's Office for over 28 years, and prior to being elected sheriff, I served as the commander of the Sheriff's Office Detectives Division and the Major Crimes Team. As a result of my years of experience in criminal investigations, I firmly believe that the disclosure of photographs and images of the deceased victims of crime should be diligently protected, and that nothing good, as far as my experience has shown me, can come from disclosing these images during public records requests. Whether it be the typical homicide, which occurs more than 100 times a year here in Oregon, a fatal traffic crash, which in 2016 claimed the lives of over 500 individuals, or a tragic school shooting like the one we experienced at Umpqua Community College on October 1st, 2015. All of these cases create opportunity through public records requests to obtain and exploit photographs and images of someone's deceased loved one. I consider this form of sensationalism, a form of sensationalism that is immoral, unethical, and harmful. And I can tell you that this type of behavior can and does occur in all news markets. Following the UCC incident, just as an example, we were attending one of the victims' funerals, and the family had asked law enforcement to ask the media to stay out of the funeral. They wanted their privacy. and we caught one of the photographers from the local newspaper sneaking into the church with a camera hidden under his jacket. We presume he was intending to take photographs, which isn't directly connected to what this Senate bill addresses, but it does demonstrate, I think, the sometimes intent of media to step over bounds and to not recognize the privacy that families of these victims have requested. As a law enforcement official, I feel a profound responsibility to seek justice for the victims of these heinous crimes. I'm hopeful that you will decide that the release of these images are not in the best interest of the public and will support the passage of Senate Bill 508, in order to protect the dignity of the deceased and the privacy of the members of these victims. On numerous occasions over the past 18 months, I have personally met with the families of the victims of UCC. They have all shared their anxiety and their concerns about the information that could potentially get shared through the public information process once the UCC shooting investigation is declared closed. And unanimously, they have asked me to do everything I can do to protect them from reliving that horrific day. I believe that this bill, if passed, will take a substantial step in the protection of privacy for these people, as well as other families of deceased victims of crime. Again, I want to thank you for the time and am willing to answer any questions you may have.
All right, Sheriff Hamlin, thank you very much. Let's go ahead and take Kevin Neely's testimony, then we'll open up for questions at that time. Kevin?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The Oregon District Attorneys are strongly in support of this legislation. I think Sheriff Hanlon very clearly articulated the moral imperative they feel around this as it relates to protecting the rights of victims. I think I would also point out, just in addition, that this is not an isolated number of requests. District attorneys and law enforcement offices regularly get requests for these images. And those requests aren't just from the media. Often they're from for-profit practitioners. And you need not go any further than Google and typing in crime scene photos to see the real damage, lasting damage this can do to victims of crime. It's a real big problem. We don't have the tools we need right now to decline these public records requests on a regular basis. This statutory change, I believe, will go a long way in addressing that concern. So again, I thank you for your time. I thank you to Sheriff Hanlon and the committee for bringing this bill. It's a real step forward for victims.
All right, thank you. Questions? All right, I'm gonna just put some stuff on the record. I'm not encouraging anyone to do this. You just go up on any engine search for the computers, Google or whatever, and put in crime scene photos. You'll be directed to various sites, and you can actually see what we're talking about. There's one that I'm looking at right now, and it gives a notice. This site contains reels and capitalized police records, recordings, and other types of disclaimers. And it's basically around one of the mass shootings that occurred in Colorado. So it's one of those situations that if you need to see what we're talking about, it's the type of stuff that's actually being put out there and how anyone could think that it doesn't have an impact on the family or if the victim lived through it and re-traumatizing them, I'd like them to explain that to me. So that's my statement. Anyone have any comments? Senator Manning.
Chair, thank you so much. Sheriff, thank you for bringing this forward. I agree. My experience, I've witnessed these things too as a former law enforcement officer, and I know what the traumatic effects to revisit that twice and then to see it splattered all over news media for someone's entertainment is the wrong thing to do, and we are morally obligated to do the best we can to support these families. So, Chair, thank you for allowing me to make my comment.
Right, Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. I remember there have been a couple sessions where we've had hearings about releasing recordings of the 911 calls, and I know there it was quite controversial, and I just wondered how this fits into that. Yeah, I don't know if that would be opposed as much as that particular bill was when I remember hearing about it. I definitely support the idea. I think it's sick that people would want to see that. But there's also the issues of entities such as newspapers or whatever wanting to protect their what they believe is their territory. So
right. So let me just put on the record, when you look at the bill, there's actually a balancing test that's built into this. This goes into public records for disclosure. It's 5.502.
It's five, the section. Mr. Chair, it's 502, but there is a balancing test. So it's...
Yeah. So 502 is a little bit stricter as to those items that are within that statute being greater protected, but we put in the balancing test that goes into 501. So there is a means for anyone who believes that this has a greater value for a public interest value that needs to be disclosed, but it would go through a judicial proceeding. Senator Dimbro?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Sheriff, thank you very much for bringing this forward. You know, recently I was in Washington, D.C. I visited the new African-American History Museum there, which is I would encourage everyone, if you can get in, to do it. Very, very powerful place. And they have an exhibit there on Emmett Till and the photograph that was released after his brutal murder. And that was a deliberate decision by his mother to release that photograph for the purpose of, you know, letting the record show and, you know, letting people see just what he had gone through in that experience. And I think a big part of the power of that exhibit and that fact was that his mother made that decision. I can easily imagine news media wanting to do that for their own, for good reasons, actually, in some cases, you know, for the same reasons that the mother did. But I think that that really should be a decision that the family has a say in. And so I'm very supportive of what you're doing.
Thank you. All right. Any other comments or questions? John, thank you very much for coming up. What we're going to do is we're going to make sure we get all the commissions crossed, I's dotted. But I expect the bill to be moving out of committee soon.
Thank you again.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 508? All right. We will go ahead and conclude and close that public hearing. And we're now into our work session stuff. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and open a work session on 131. And the purpose for this is to allow for, first I want a summary of the bill from Josh, and then we're going to go ahead and let, I guess, Mary, you're wanting to come forward, and then I'm going to go ahead and ask Aaron to also come forward so we can just have maybe a little dialogue if we feel like it's appropriate.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 131 modifies the circumstances under which the court may allow telephonic testimony in civil and juvenile dependency proceedings. There are two amendments on OLIS today. The -2 amendments grant the court discretion to allow remote location testimony based upon good cause, unless the court determines that the testimony would prejudice another party and that prejudice outweighs the good cause. The -2 amendments provide the court with a non-exclusive list of factors to consider in balancing the good cause and the prejudice to the other party. And the -2 amendment prohibits the court from using telephonic testimony unless the court finds that video transmission is not readily available. With the -2 amendment, Senate Bill 131 has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. As I mentioned, there's also a -3 posted on OLIS. The -3 is identical to the -2, except that it would require video testimony and prohibit telephonic testimony if the court finds that the credibility and demeanor of the witness is critical or that the issues the witnesses will testify about may be outcome determinative. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Mary?
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. First, I just wanted to thank this chair for allowing me to come up here and outline to the committee what Dash 3 does. I also want to extend thanks to Aaron Knott and to the participants of the work group that OCDLA was invited to and got to participate in over the last couple months. As you recall, I appeared in front of you just a few weeks ago and testified regarding the Dash 2 in Senate Bill 131 and requested time to be able to have another conversation with the DOJ and also have another meeting in order to see if we could come to some kind of consensus on an additional idea that that Gail Meyer and I had, admittedly last minute. And so we do appreciate being able to come up here and present our Dash 3 to you. Mr. Nasby is correct. There's only one difference between the Dash 2 and the Dash 3. So essentially, the Dash 2 restructures the original statute ORS 45400 significantly. It actually creates new factors, and it breaks up kind of the analysis that the court goes through. And so in the first, in the original statute, the court considers good cause factors, and then there are certain factors that, if exist, the court may not allow telephonic testimony. So that's the original statute. What the Dash 2 does is breaks this down into good cause factors and also factors that would show prejudice. And so what we have are two people or two parties who are one person is moving for telephonic testimony, and they'll get to kind of go through this list of good factor, good cause factors. You have another person who's opposing for whatever reason, and then there are prejudice factors. And so that person then would go through and show that to the court. The difference between the original statute and the Dash 2 is that the judge essentially is tasked to weigh those against each other. In the original statute, it's OCDLA's position that the court still retains discretion to make that kind of balancing, and our position is that we don't believe that the statute needs to be changed in the way that the Dash 2 changes it. However, in attempts to compromise and to be to essentially go along and try to and try to participate in a meaningful way, our Dash 3 incorporates all of Dash 2, and so we are essentially coming to the table and saying, yes, we understand that that the DOJ and other I believe the other members are neutral, but that there is some thought that maybe the statute needs to be broken out in a different way, and so we're willing to go there. However, we do have some deep-seated concerns, and the deep-seated concerns that we have really do focus on dependency cases, termination of parental rights, and removal of children from homes. That's a big deal to us. We do understand that the statute impacts other type of civil matters. If you look at the original statute, and if you look at the Dash 2, and if you look at the Dash 3, jury trials kind of have their own section that says you can only allow telephonic testimony if the reasons are compelling. And so it kind of adds this additional standard that's not being given to other situations or scenarios that we think are important. So what the Dash 2 does is it looks at the prejudice factors, and if you look at the first two, A and B, of the prejudice factors, and I did upload a one-pager that's actually four pages, and so I apologize, but the first page kind of articulates what our position is, and then the last three pages are essentially a chart that shows what the original statute does, the standard, the good cause factors, the standard for not allowing testimony, and the prejudice factors, as well as telephone testimony versus visual transmission, and then it compares the Dash 2 and the Dash 3. And so ultimately, when you look at the prejudice factors, what we believe, and the reason why we're coming up here, and we understand this last minute, but the reason why we're coming up here and saying this is because we believe that A and B are so different from the rest of the factors. A is whether the ability to evaluate the credibility and demeanor of a witness or party in person is critical to the outcome of the proceeding, and B, whether the non-moving party demonstrates that face-to-face cross-exam is necessary because the issue or issues the witness or party will testify about may be determinative of the outcome. What we're asking in that situation is we understand that the court's going to go through the weighing process no matter what based on Dash 2, but what we're asking for is for if those two scenarios crop up and the non-moving party is able to show to the judge these things exist, but the court still decides when he weighs that or she weighs that that they haven't, that the prejudice doesn't outweigh the good cause, then we're asking for visual transmission. And so in the old days, the only opportunity that you would have, right, would be to drive to court. And then as technology gets better, we've got telephones. What we're saying is, you know, this is 2017. We're dealing with incredibly important issues. We're talking about removal of children. We're talking about termination of parental rights. And so we believe that if those two scenarios crop up, then it's critical to see this person. It's critical for the judge to see this person, and it's critical for the parties to be able to see this person. And so we understand that it can be difficult for expert witnesses to drive out to smaller counties. We understand that it might be difficult in some places for them to organize video transmission, but we believe it's possible. We believe it's important, and that's why we're pushing forward our Dash 3. I appreciate, Chair, you allowing me to come up here and explain this. It is very important to us. We're not trying to just cause a little bit of trouble, even though we are causing a little bit of trouble, but it does matter. And so I am respectfully requesting just to hold off on the work session so that if any of these members have questions, I can answer those questions, and also to just absorb the information so that you can make an informed decision between the Dash 2 and the Dash 3. Thank you.
Should I respond now? We're at a situation where, since you're starting to drive the car,
yes,
make sure you got the seatbelt on, because we're going to get going faster and faster, and we're going to be making decisions
absolutely
very quickly. Aaron.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Aaron Knott, legislative director for the Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to respond. So Senate Bill 131 has been under development for months. We met with the bar, the trial lawyers, the DAs, had everybody together. The problem, again, that we're trying to solve with this bill is we're responding to a case that we believe essentially gives one party the ability to exercise a veto over the use of telephonic testimony. And that was concerning for a number of reasons, but one of the issues that we were the most disturbed about is we believe the system that it is set up is that in Multnomah or Marion County, it will be easier to introduce testimony because, you know, you can tend to just bring your witnesses in physically than it will be in the more far-flung parts of the state. The system that 131 sets up, describing briefly, you have to make a good cause finding to get your telephonic testimony in the door in the first place. There is a preference for live testimony. It's always the best. We know that. But if you need telephonic testimony because your witness can't get there because of cost, your witness is, you know, Aunt Betty who has a bad back and she needs to come in, and, you know, that would be a real hardship for her, there needs to be some mechanism. If you can make that good cause finding, then the question becomes, is this going to prejudice the other party? The way we wrote this, we believe it pretty much, in a lot of the cases, a dependency case where termination of parental rights is going to be the result, that is going to weigh very heavily in direction of prejudice. This is written to allow judges to make those decisions, and we did that deliberately. It's a courtroom management tool, and an important one. Mm-hmm. So in a case where a person is looking at the termination of their parental rights as the result of a hearing, we believe that the court will absolutely find that the factors supporting a finding of prejudice exist. Evaluating the credibility and demeanor of a witness, whether it's going to be outcome determinative. That's in the Dash 2s now. The concern we have about the Dash 3s is that it ultimately effectuates exactly what we were trying to avoid. The Dash 3s say video conferencing is all you can use if a witness has the potential to be outcome determinative. Well, almost every witness you introduce has the potential to be outcome determinative about something. For example, you're trying to figure out whether you can place a child in an available home, whether there's Aunt Betty's willing to take the child on. Aunt Betty basically just has to attest to the circumstances of her home. You know, is it safe for the child? And that's outcome determinative. You know, another one
You have somebody who's laying a foundation for business records, and that's the subject of the litigation. All they have to do is say, look, these are our records. This is our business. They have to do that to open up the door for the evidence. That's outcome determinative. Do they need to be physically present for that? I'm not convinced. What this does is allow a judge to make those calls flexibly as to how to manage their courtroom in the way that's best for their case. I don't think I can ever get behind the dash threes, because ultimately, at the end of the day, video conferencing is more available in Multnomah than it is in Douglas. You know, I heard on the radio coming in today that we're shutting down 10 libraries in Douglas County because they weren't able to pass a bond. And I know that in Josephine County, you've got one sheriff in an area the size of Rhode Island. And to look at that disposition and say, well, we need you to pay for video equipment to get witnesses in at all, even if there's a judge thinks there's a need, just doesn't work. So the dash threes are not something that DOJ could ever get behind. I don't think we'd be able to resolve that dispute via further conversation, so we are still supporting the dash twos.
Questions? All right, thank you all very much. We're in work session, so I'm going to ask colleagues. We have the dash twos. We've heard the presentations. They're ready. The bill's ready to go forward if we want to adopt the dash twos and move forward. If there are individuals on this committee who want some time to think and contemplate the dash threes or want more information, the chair is willing to do that, but the chair is ready to go forward on the bill as it is now with the dash twos.
I think the arguments with regard to visual are very important arguments, and I think they're worth considering. So I would like some more time for review, or move the dash threes instead of the dash twos.
All right, well, the dash threes can't be moved today. They just were filed, and the only reason we could actually take testimony on them today is because it's been over an hour that they've been posted before we took that testimony. So at this point, this chair is willing to not move forward. We'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 131. And what we're going to do is we're going to carry over Senate Bill 131, and I've already mentioned Senate Bill 487. We'll put them on the same day, which will be next Wednesday. I believe that is April 5th, but it's next Wednesday, a week from yesterday. With that, we're going to go ahead and I believe takes care of the work that we have for today. Colleagues?
8 a.m. on Monday.
Yeah. Colleagues, we're now kind of in this crunch time, as I was telling Mary. And so our session on Monday will start at 8 a.m., not 8:30, 8 a.m. With that, we're adjourned. Adjourned. 8 a.m. With that, we're